Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm. Escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Getting the big thumbs up from Liz over there in the booth, which means it's time to start. Welcome, and thank you so much for tuning into the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza on a lovely day here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You are listening to The Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. Each week on The Farm Report this season, we are exploring the numbers, the quantitative space of what makes our food production system work and or not work. Off air, I am the executive director of the Heritage Radio Network, and every October, I help run the Goat-tober, the No Goat Left Behind project with Heritage Foods USA, so definitely check out some goat this October. Today, we are going to be exploring the ever-exciting, varied, historic world of grains. And we are joined, we have back in the studio once again, Amber Lamke. Amber is the president and owner of Maine Grains at the Somerset Gristmill. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Erin.
In addition to Amber, we have some folks from her team and Eric Levine, who's the head miller. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And Matthew Dubois, who is the owner-operator of The Bankery. Now, The Bankery is a bakery a bakery in an old bank. That's right?
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. And you are located just like steps from the Gristmill.
Right.
That's convenient.
Very.
Does that mean that, you just pop over with your wheelbarrow and like load up with grains whenever you want? It's a very like medieval situation.
Pretty much.
Awesome. I wanted to kind of jump off. We, of course, at the Heritage Radio Network have been following the grain conversation, in particular through the leadership of June Russell, who runs the Green Markets Regional Grains Project, something we find kind of super interesting and critical to so many different spaces in the food world. Scrolling through Twitter yesterday, I came upon a tweet from someone who tweets under the name Shit Food Blogger, they were putting out 52 weeks. It was like an editorial calendar for food magazines or food publications. And their suggestion for week number 38 was Ancient Grains Week. And I was like, oh, sweet, Ancient Grains. I love it. And then they went on to say, readership plummets, editors and writers are fired, food journalism dies, the freaka remains. And I was like, damn, that is harsh. But what it made me wonder is when we're talking, this grain conversation, is it a darling of food writers right now? Is it having a moment? And is that not translating to the public consumption? Are grains like sexy or not sexy? And when we think about food writing and food media in general, really kind of like what's its role and how does it actually impact what's happening for producers and people running the infrastructure that makes these things work like you do, Amber. So I wanted to get a little bit kind of your take on that, your take on the role that media has been playing in supporting the work that you guys do.
That's a really great question. And I'm happy to address it. I think grains are sexy right now, and part of that is coming from the fact that, I know I had a realization about 10 years ago that folks that were interested in eating local foods and adopting these 100-mile diets and local vore challenges, I remember reading the rules of my area local vore challenge, and you had your wild cards, and your wild cards might be olive oil, salt,
lemons,
grains. And I remember reading, well, why is that? Why are grains a wild card? We used to grow lots of grains in these areas. And so, that's one of the things that's prompting thinking And so I think it's new to the consciousness of folks that care about where their food comes from, that grains could come from their region too. So that's cool. I do think that we will know a lot more about grains and health and changes to plant varieties over the last 50 years as the science gets better. And honestly, the science is just still out. So there's a lot of speculating going on with ancient grains and modern grains and plant breeding and lots of misconceptions right now
Making it confusing, I think, for consumers. We are going to be joined in the second half of the show by Amy Halloran to talk a little bit about her new book, The New Bread Basket. Great resources for folks who are interested in kind of understanding what's happening in the grain movement a little bit more broadly. But for folks who maybe aren't familiar with Maine grains, maybe give us the elevator version. I mean, I enjoy your delicious oatmeal, so that's mostly how I interact with you guys. But for folks who haven't yet had the pleasure, what should they know about Maine grains?
Sure, thanks. I think it's important to say that our mill has been open for about 3 years now, but we've been in the research and development and business planning stage since about 2007. I'm not a farmer. I did not know much about grains prior to starting this project, and I'd never owned my own business. Really, this project for
us... So you're crazy.
I'm crazy. But in our neck of the woods, Skowhegan's smack dab in the center of the state, where we've lost a lot of our shoe mills and paper mills and former grist mills that used to employ people. So I come to this work first through community revitalization and trying to think about what are the next things that will employ people and where are the leakages happening in our rural communities for gainful employment. I was tapped in 2007 to help organize a conference called the Kneading Conference, K-N-E-A-D. And that started as a gathering of farmers, millers, bakers, wood-fired oven builders, anyone in that, what I call the grains cluster, the cluster of goods and services necessary for a local grain economy to thrive. And we wanted to bring people together from across the country to talk about what it would take to reinvigorate our local grain economy. So that's how I come to this conversation, is first as an organizer and someone who's curious, and someone who cares about the revitalization of my small town of 9,000 people. We started this mill in part inspired by the Kneading Conference and in recognition that the lack of infrastructure is part of why we don't have local flour and local oats and local grains anymore. Lest people question the kind of hip or sexy nature of grains right now, it's probably important for you to know that we come from a community where 51% of our population qualifies for federal food assistance. So we are as much concerned about what local folks are able to eat and have access to in our area as we are about, serving the popular nature of grains right now.
That makes a lot of sense. Eric, did you have a grist mill experience?
I had no experience coming into this.
You guys were a powerhouse team starting it out the gate. so where did you learn? How did you get oriented?
I started out as a volunteer for our farm-to-table cafe that's attached to the grist mill. And just through connections, I got hooked up with Amber and was offered a job. And I love doing it. I think it's great.
So for folks who've maybe never, like myself, been to a mill, can you maybe just describe it a little bit? Like if I walked up, like what would I be looking at? What do you see there?
You would see a lot of equipment that you have no idea what it does.
Figured. Is it loud?
It is very loud, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we wear a lot of protective face masks and ear protection. And everything is chutes and ladders. You'll see everything is gravity fed, so you'll see things going up. You'll see things coming down. And, yeah, it's interesting.
Amber, how many different types of grains are you processing?
Right now...
Is that the right word, processing?
Yeah, okay. Yep. We have doubled the number of farmers we've been working with every year that we've been in operation. So we're in our third year, and the variety of grains is increasing all the time. So we process a lot of hard red spring wheat, a lot of oats. Gaining is rye. We also have buckwheat, and for the first year this year, we have spelt. We're bringing in some open-pollinated flint corn from nearby Rhode Island and a few other things that are voids that we can't yet find in Maine. So our diversity is increasing all the time, and it's very exciting. I did fail to mention that. I thought maybe Eric would say this, but one of the quirkier natures of our project is that we, in order to kill a lot of birds with one stone, we decided to situate this new mill in a former Victorian jailhouse in our downtown.
So a bank and a jail, so, creating the innovation of bread. And I think in a really interesting way speaks to kind of what you were bringing up before around revitalizations of small towns.
Never in a million years would I have thought that a jailhouse would make a good mill. But as it turns out, there were four stories in the tallest section of the building. That's very advantageous in milling because you can move grains to the top level and then gravity feed from the top down through your milling equipment. The building is one of these what you might call white elephant buildings in your community where it was due to go vacant. Nobody knew what was going to happen to it. Heck, it had a fully functional commercial kitchen, and a lot of our farmers in our community wanted access to it for food processing. We were able to get this 14,000 square foot building for $65,000 and proceeded to raise a lot of money to do the renovation. So it's been it is uniquely well served for us, not to mention that the 3 foot thick concrete cinder block walls are pretty soundproof, so we can make a whole lot of noise on the inside of the building and you don't hear a thing on the street.
Matt, is that similar for the bread baking operation being situated in a former bank? What are the pros and cons there?
Some of the pros, we opened up the bakery shortly before the mill opened. And turn the vaults into our walk-in coolers. It's an open concept retail establishment with a wholesale arm to our business. But you walk in, you can see us bake, you can see the vault doors, you can kind of get that whole bank feel about it. So we try to keep the noise down so our retail customers have a pleasant experience.
You know, I'm looking at the top 10 wheat states in the U.S., pulling from, obviously, the USDA. These are 2012 numbers. So number one, you have Kansas, two, Dakota, then it's Montana, Oklahoma, Washington, South Dakota, Idaho, Texas, kind of a surprise for me there, Minnesota, and Colorado. So you're looking at bushels harvested, Kansas up there at the top with, just under 400,000. And then Colorado at number 10, just under 75,000. I don't see Maine anywhere on this list.
No, in fact, I was surprised to learn. I took a trip to Kansas as part of my education and took a week-long flour milling course at the International Grains Program in Kansas, one of only two places in the world to still learn flour milling. And, you know, there's one day we're in lecture and the map of the wheat-producing states is up on the slide, and Maine wasn't even recognized as a wheat-producing state, and I knew there was some wheat being grown in Maine. When asked, it was that Maine didn't register because we didn't have 1,000 acres or more of wheat in production for human consumption at that time, so we didn't even register on the map as a grain-producing state. So, no, we're tiny. There had still historically been a lot of grains grown for livestock feed in Maine, a lot of barley and oats. But grain for human consumption is fairly new, coming back into rotations. One of the inspiring statistics that even gave me confidence to even try a mill in Maine was learning that in the 1830s, my county of Somerset County in Maine alone produced 239,000 bushels of wheat. Now, a bushel of wheat is 60 pounds, 60 pounds to the bushel. So you do the math, that's a lot of wheat back at a time where harvesting was happening by hand or with horses. Tremendous amount of grain. So the Northeast was actually a net exporter of grain during those years and gave me a lot of confidence that even though we might not restore to that level of production, we certainly can grow grains.
And, you know, you mentioned a couple of the different types of things that are passing through your mill from Maine and from the region right now. Are those new farmers or are they farmers who have been growing these products and using those things through other outlets, or is it a mix? I mean, how has the kind of growing ag and kept up or is catching up or is, I feel like maybe neither of those are really the right words, but how does that kind of like relationship work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it, there are some experienced farmers and some new farmers. That's the short answer. But the longer answer is that we need to be thinking about agricultural systems and their fragility based on the knowledge that is present or lost as well. So in our region, you still have some third generation farmers that have some grain growing still happening on their farms where maybe they've lost connection to what it takes to maintain human grade grain. So a lot of that has had to come back along with the millstones and cleaning equipment and whatnot. So we've been very lucky to be working hand in hand with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension that has received funding in order to work with farmers over the last 10 years. That's been great timing for us because farmers do need some help with organic systems, weed management, proper storage, how to dry grains down and hang on to them for the full year, how to transport grain and unload grain and all of those kinds of things. So it is a system and it's all interconnected. In Maine, one of the logical things we looked at is that our town is located in the densest belt of organic dairy farms in our state. So a lot of those farms sometimes have combines because they may have been growing corn or they may have been planting other things. And so the infrastructure to take that leap to grains was not that hard for a dairy farmer that's already used to working with large machinery. That's worked to our favor because these are the farmers that are saying, well, sure, I'll plant 30 acres of grain. I'll try it out. You know, they're not too scared by it. The other thing I like to remind people is that there are a whole lot of reasons on a farm and for the sake of the soil that you might want to grow grains. Harvesting the grain for food is one benefit, but having the organic straw, for example, is a huge benefit and potential cost savings for an organic dairy or livestock farmer that has to buy in organic straw right now. So that's another great reason to be growing grains. Another is just simply that if you till in the straw or the stubble, you're improving soil health and water retention and carbon sequestration, you know, all of those things that we care about right now for the sake of the environment and the soil. So, you know, again, grains are a system and food is just one part of that.
So in Maine, would it be correct that most of the grain producers that you're currently working with, grain is like one segment of what they do on their farm or their property, not that maybe the primary focus?
Absolutely. Right. So these are folks that, like I said, have animals or maybe they're organic potato growers that need a rotation with potatoes. Grains are a heavy nitrogen feeder. They suck up a lot of nitrogen from the soil. So they want to rotate year after year with legumes or other things that will fix nitrogen, clover, hay. You really want to see a good multi-year crop rotation on farms that are growing grains. So these are farmers that need to be doing other things and they need to have other markets for their rotation crops as well. We're in a major expansion right now at the mill to really upscale our oat production. We just got a USDA grant in order to purchase new equipment from Germany, which will allow us to produce about four times as many oats more efficiently than we currently can. And that's going to be a real boon for Maine farms because oats are one of these grains that actually like Maine's cool, wet climate. They're familiar to Maine farmers because they've been growing them as a green manure or as an organic weed suppressant. Weed management tool for a long time. So to have a market for the oats is actually of benefit to these farms. And so we're very excited to be expanding oat production in Maine.
And I don't know if you know this, but I'm just wondering from your time out in Kansas and then kind of rethinking through those like top 10 wheat producing states, states where they're producing such a high volume, can I assume that those farmers are primarily just producing wheat, that it's like not part of a larger system, or is it, or maybe you don't know, I'm just curious.
that tends to be more of a monocropping system because it is heavily reliant on fertilizers and herbicides in order to manage year after year wheat, corn, soy.
Okay, cool. Well, Matt, just a question for you. You know, opening a bakery in a community that Amber said, you know, that is what is 50% of the community is
qualifies for federal food assistance.
So how did you go about kind of deciding what type of bread to produce and how to price it and how to make a product that was like a good fit for where you are?
We opened the bakery with a passion to make everything from scratch. So that's our business model, that anything that we do from start to finish, all the parts and pieces will be made in-house. We do a lot of loaf-style breads that are not artisan-based to fit the needs of our community. People can take an Anadama loaf and make a great sandwich, or challah bread to make French toast, things like that. So we tailor our products to a majority of our clientele.
What are like some of your favorite breads personally to bake and make and experiment with?
I really like a miche that we made that had a dried fig in it. We used the main grains, 86% sifted flour, so I had some of the bran removed. It made a really nice, beautiful piece of bread.
And are you distributing outside of the bakery, or primarily people come to the bakery?
We do a little wholesaling through the bakery, mostly in burger buns and breads for restaurants. But we're mostly a retail establishment.
And are you guys the only bakery game in town, or you got some competition up there?
We're pretty much the only bakery in a 30-mile radius.
All right.
So you know, Matt really does walk this delicate balance of giving customers what they want in our community, which sometimes is white bread or soft loaves. And on the flip side, we've been so pleasantly surprised to work with Matt at the bakery because there is this commitment to experimentation and a commitment to sneaking whole grains into the croissant dough and sneaking whole grains into the muffins, and making sure that pleases customers at the same time. One of our last trips to New York City, we came home and Matt was inspired to try a bread club where it would allow them to stretch their wings a little bit, try some different breads that they might ordinarily not be sure if they could sell all of them. But if they had committed bread club members, then they would know where that bread was going. And so that was great fun. I think it was a big success, and you plan to do that again, right?
Definitely, yeah.
Awesome. I love a good bread club. Well, so a modern white flour mill can easily produce around 600 tons of white flour a day. How does that compare to what you guys are doing?
So 600 tons a day in a modern white flour mill, we are actually on track to produce 600 tons in a year. So very different scale. And when we set out to start our mill, we knew that we did not want to be a small little milling operation on the back corner of a barn somewhere. We knew we wanted sizable infrastructure in order to serve a region and be be able to sustain ourselves and be profitable. But we are nowhere near the scale of a modern flour mill. So that comes with a lot of challenges. It has been very challenging to source equipment that is appropriately sized. Even New England's farm sizes are smaller, comparatively speaking, to what you're going to find in Kansas. So whereas the combines out in Kansas now are automated, can operate on GPS, they don't even need a rider in them. We've got 300-acre plots in central Maine where you'd never get away with a combine that large, or you can't get them through the fences, or they can't turn around on the farm plot. So there are scale challenges, and so I would say that our mill size is unique, but we are thrilled to be watching some parallel projects happening across the country. There's a wonderful little mill in Arizona now. There's a great mill out in Los Angeles, of all places, down in North Carolina. And we all network with each other as we try to bring back a regionally scaled mill.
Yeah, I remember talking with an organization out in Nebraska about a year ago, and they were talking about how, you know, farm sizes just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And when a farmer would pass away, and if no one in the family wanted to take over the land, that often these farms would get bought, that the adjacent farm would dig a hole, bulldoze the house and all the buildings into the hole, and then use that spot as a place to turn around their tractor. So, I mean, I think when you're just thinking about, like, kind of scale and scope and size of farms, you know, you can get really, really big, which obviously produces a ton of, you know, whatever that farm is growing. But it's a very different type of operation, really, across the board. Well, man, so much to cover here. We do have to take a short station break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Amy Halloran to talk a little bit more about her new book, The New Bread Basket, and run through a little bit more grain talk. Hang tight. We'll be right back.
Apple picking season. Join escapemaker.com and the New York Apple Association at the Union Square Green Market, Friday, September 18th and Friday, October 16th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the 2015 Apple Palooza Games. Go to the escapemaker.com pop-up booth for all your regional agritourism information and a chance to play apple-themed games like Giant Apple-themed Twister. You could win a bag of delicious apple cider donuts and fresh apple juice. Everyone will receive helpful information on where to go for pick your own apples this harvest season and a fresh apple grown in New York State. There's no better time to explore outside the city. Soak up the fresh air and scenery like a butterfly and support your local orchard. Log on to escapemaker.com to get inspired and make your escape through the net.
Hi, this is Dave Arnold from Cooking Issues, and I'm here to talk to you about the Museum of Food and Drink, which is finally getting a brick-and-mortar space right here in Brooklyn, New York. So the Museum of Food and Drink is opening the MOFAD Lab, our first laboratory and gallery space, where we will be putting on an exhibition called Making It or Faking It, the History of the Flavor Industry. And it tackles a very important topic, which is how the food system got to be the way it is now as a result of the intervention of the flavor industry, how that happened. Get your tickets at tickets.mofad.org to come see the first exhibit ever of the Museum of Food and Drink at the MOFAD Lab, brought to you by Infinity on 62 Bayard Street.
All right, we are back. I am so excited for the MOFAD exhibit. If you are in New York, check that out. If you are not, definitely visit their website, mofad.org. Lots of great recordings, courtesy of Heritage Radio Network, that share some of the types of conversation and innovation that's coming out of that team and things to look forward to in the future. We, of course, are continuing our conversation here in the studio, looking at the wide world of grains, and are joined on the line by Amy Halloran, author of The New Bread Basket. Amy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So one of the things that we were kind of touching on just before the break was this kind of community exchange and the size of, like, the bread world. And Amber, I was hoping maybe you could kind of orient us to Amy, and, like, by way of kind of explaining, when we're looking at grains and bread and information exchange, how those things kind of, like, happen and work, and how we really look to kind of build a movement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. These regional networks are really fairly new, and it's been in the last decade that folks are retooling and trying to figure this all out. There are not many stone millers in this country anymore. There's not many organic processors anymore. So there's a set of challenges that we can all support each other in addressing. So, you know, one of my favorite stories to this effect is, you know, we ordered this stone mill from Austria and we got it all set up in our building and placed. And the first day we ever turned it on, we had no idea what we were listening to or what the right sounds were. And so we picked up the phone and we called Dave Miller out on the West Coast in California because we knew he had one of these machines. And we held the phone to the mill and we said, "Dave, does this sound right?" You know, so we're doing a lot of coaching with each other in different projects. And I'm excited that you have Amy on the line because really no one knows the Northeast efforts better than Amy. She's been following these issues alongside some of these projects for the last 10 years or so. And her new book really captures the people involved and the movement so succinctly and beautifully. So
that's great. Amy, why now? Like, what prompted the writing of this book?
Well, it was a single cookie. My husband brought me a cookie that had really, really good flavors of grains. The oats and the wheat were as loud and clear as the very good butter and chocolate. And this was from Wild Hive Farm. So it stood out so much, I knew that I had to follow it back to the field. I've been a baker always, and this was so intriguing. And I was also intrigued with history, so I was wondering about the same time, why don't we make food around here anymore? Why don't we make flour around here anymore? I had run a farmer's market in Troy, New York, and so I was acquainted with everything but grains, and I began with that cookie to look in. And very early on into my investigation, I was asking people who I should talk to, and they said, "Oh, you have to go to the kneading conference. You have to go up to Maine." And it became this this castle that I needed to see, and it really fulfilled my hopes of being everything that the revival of regional grain production can be. You know, a very community-based effort, people relearning how to work together with these old tools and new versions of old tools and building relationships and great food.
You titled the book The New Bread Basket. What is the old bread basket?
Right. Okay, so most of the wheat and grains we get in this country are grown in the wheat belts, and that's places where, over the course of the 19th and early 20th century, the production and processing of grains got centralized. So everything off of the supermarket shelf is likely from Kansas or Montana or the Dakotas, someplace that generally has dry summers and big fields the size of, a lot bigger than anything we have in the Northeast. So the new bread basket is really the older bread basket because people have always traveled with their grains. And, you know, when the pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock, they tried to grow wheat. It didn't do so hot in the New England summers. So they ended up with rye and the resident grain, corn, from Native Americans. And so that's what a bread basket looked like then. Maine was a bread basket for the Civil War. So was New York. We had bread baskets. There was an oat basket in Vermont in the Champlain Valley. But people are now tooling up to get these bread baskets right back where they belong, I think, closer to the eaters and closer to the millers that can make really great food.
So at the you know, front cover of your book, you talk about grain growers, plant breeders, millers, maltsters, bakers, brewers, local food activists, and how they're all redefining our daily loaf. I think one of the things that is a little hard for folks who are just bread eaters to wrap their head around is how many people are both necessary, but also engage in the evolution of the grain story here in the U.S. And I'm wondering for you, you know, from those kind of different groups, what were the big surprises for you? Like, oh, I never really like thought about that part, or oh, this is like so key. What jumped out at you in your kind of research and learning that was like a little bit unexpected about the infrastructure of the bread situation?
Right. Well, I think everything was a surprise because flour is this banal, dull ingredient that sits on a supermarket shelf in a 5-pound bag. The most, you know, until I started looking at this stuff, the most exciting thing I ever thought about a flour bag was that the Bronte sisters used to write tiny little stories on flour bags. I thought that was the most useful thing. No, but there's so much more. I think maybe the best metaphor is that as I looked at all of this work, I was stunned by how many people are intersecting to try to make this happen. To get tomatoes from field to table is not as elaborate a process, but to get grains growing in a place, food grade grains growing in a place where they haven't been grown in 100 years, you need researchers looking at varieties. You need farmers to get storage, farmers to get the know-how to grow to food grade rather than feed grade, animal feed grade. They're very different goals that you're shooting for when you're trying to grow this. It's a whole new world that people are trying to put together. And it's, I think of it as a human muscle. And one of the great, great people/entities is Green Market Regional Grain Project. I thought of them as a human muscle, trying to move this effort to build a regional grain shed in the Northeast again. And I saw the work of places like Green Market and their collaborators, PASA in Pennsylvania, Northeast Organic Farming Association, Ogren, which is an independent farmer and grower research network. All of these people are working together to do something that's really hard. Since grains are a commodity crop, it's there's this price struggle, you know, to get a quality grain in a locale costs so much more than anything else. So you really need heart and soul put into it. And the people who are putting their lives and work on the line for grains are really remarkable.
I always think about this interview we did with Jim Leahy, where he was talking about, you know, his vision of the future of New York City was that there would be a bakery on every corner, like there is a coffee shop on every corner, and that each bakery would have a bread that was grown with a specific grain and the specific type of bread for that particular bakery, in the same way you have these specialty brewed coffee in the origin story. We've done such a, you know, the coffee industry has done such a really interesting job of telling and celebrating that story. And I personally, in that future fantasy, would love to eat all that delicious bread. One of the things I wanted to hear about from both you and Amber, if you have thoughts, is kind of the gender issue when we're thinking about grains and bread baking. And maybe, Amy, if you can talk a little bit in a historical context of the role women like have or haven't played. And then, Amber, I'm just wondering from you maybe a little bit more currently, when you look around who's kind of like leading and shaping this movement, if you're seeing a gender breakdown there. But, Amy, maybe we'll start with you.
Sure. So I want to go back to the coffee for a second. That's a beautiful metaphor. I think coffee mills are a great introduction to seeing how fresh flour really can grow. Fresh coffee, nobody argues about anymore that it's really tasty. So fresh flour, people will be able to tell soon, too, is really great. As far as women in bread, if you think about American bread, we didn't so much have a tradition of the village bakery, until 1920, most of our bread was made at home, and then very quickly we shifted to industrial production. I mean, the transition was already underway, but that was the delineation when we had, we got more of our bread from out of the house. So it was an indoor maternal kind of thing, baking bread. I think about, you know, there's a lot of women in pastry now, and not so many women making bread. And I've had conversations with people talking about, well, is it just the 50-pound sacks of flour that people don't want to lift? What? I don't really know how it all plays out, but I'm sure, I know that there are a lot of women doing a lot of the, that muscle work I was talking about, the research and food activism that's making this happen. There are some real taped superheroes like June Russell at Green Market and Elizabeth Dick at Ogren, and Ellie Ragosa does a lot of great seed researching, and Ellen Mallory is another great seed researcher, and she's up at the University of Maine, and Heather Darby is at the University of Vermont. So there's a lot of women in sort of I hesitate to use the word support because I don't like the secondary sound that it gives, but there are women behind the scenes making the regional grain tasting happen.
Yeah, that makes sense. Amber, anything you want to add there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm thinking this through. All the farmers that I deal with are men. At this mm-hmm. point, when I went out to the Kansas course, I was the only female in the class and no female instructors in the world of milling at the International Grains Program. And yet, ironically, a lot of these mill projects that I know of across the country, there's, you know, Nancy in Los Angeles, there's Jennifer Lapidus down in Asheville, North Carolina, there's Emma Zimmerman down in Arizona, there's myself in Maine. There are a lot of these milling efforts that are either being led led by yeah. women. So in some cases, they are daughters of the farmers who started them. But, you know, Sarah Williams is poised to help take over the mill of her father's up in northern Maine. So a lot of women leading the milling effort and the return to good flour.
Well, yeah, definitely. Listeners, if you're out there and you know of great operations that we should be profiling here on the network or things or people we want to shout out, I do think whenever I'm like we're talking in agriculture and especially when you move into the production space, those gender things just come up in a lot of like different and interesting ways. I always get to get a little bit of a sense of how, you know, what the finger on the pulse is from where you guys sit. Well, just about out of time here, which makes me really sad. I do want to give the folks in the room a quick chance and maybe just a brief minute to talk a little bit about maybe one kind of hope and dream for the future in the bread space. And Amy, why don't we let you start?
Well, I would hope that everybody can taste fresh flour, because once you taste it, you won't want anything else. And I'm going to be making pancakes at Green Market on Saturday in Union Square from 11 to 2:30 so that you can taste what an incredible food this is.
Oh, yum. Eric, how about you for your work? Hopes or dreams for the future, something that would make your job easier, better, more fun, or something that you want to bring to your community through the work at the mill?
I bring a lot of work to the community through the mill right now. I would love to see that expand. We have a huge wood-fired pizza operation that goes on in our community. I'm proud to be a part of it, and we are ever-growing, incorporating new things, whether it be spent grains used in the dough that the bakery makes for us using main grains, things like that, that just keep expanding and getting bigger and bigger and bringing the community closer and closer together.
That's great. That's awesome. Matt, how about you? Any bread projects on the horizon?
We want to continue using more whole grains in our bakery. And I think as we have more of a following for those types of items through our bread clubs, through more education in the community, people more and more are moving away from the white bread still in our community. So I think we're giving a good push for that education, and then the demand will follow.
Awesome. And Amber, I will give you the last word.
Well, I am hopeful for the continuation of this trend toward village bakeries that use local flour and expose really delicious bread to their communities. It improves health, it improves local economies, and never fear if you're not a home baker, as Amy will show you at the Green Market soon or wherever you might catch up with her. Pancakes is always a great entry point for local flour, so please try that at home.
Yeah, and then check, they can find you at maingrains.com. Like you on Facebook, Kneading Conference. You do have dates, right?
Yes, come see us in Maine at the Kneading Conference, July 28 and 29. You can find us at kneadingconference.com.
And then definitely check out Amy's book, The New Bread Basket. Great read. It gives you a real kind of finger on the pulse of what's happening in this regional grain movement. And like you heard earlier, really touching on all the different players in this really exciting space. So thank you all for joining me in the studio. It's been great to have such a full house.
Thanks so much, Erin.
Thank you.
And Amy, thank you so much for calling in. Awesome. Hang tight. We will be back after a short break for the Escape Maker segment.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
It is time once again for the Escape Maker segment of the Farm Report, and I'm really excited to be joined on the line by Steve Clark from Prospect Hill Orchard. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Erin.
So you are calling in from up in Milton, New York. Give us a little bit of a rundown on Prospect Orchards. You guys raise a variety of stone fruit and apples, but give us a little sense of the size and scope of your operation.
Okay, well, it's Prospect Hill Orchards, and that's because 198 years ago, my great-great-great-grandfather moved to Prospect Hill in Milton, which is about a mile west of the Hudson. And Milton, for your listeners, is about 75 miles north of Manhattan. So, yes, we are very diversified. I have a daughter, Pam, who goes to some of the farmers markets in New York City. So for her, we grow all the berries and, you know, some of the odd things like rhubarb and quince and, you know, there's even some odd apples we grow just for her. But we are diversified. We do grow sweet and sour cherries, and we have apricots and plums and peaches and prunes and nectarines and pears and apples.
Yum. I'm like all of those things, all of those things. Well, I was taking a perusal through your website, and I noticed you have a quite extensive section on some of your green farming practices, and I wanted to talk about a few in particular. I wonder if you can share with our listeners a little bit about your solar program.
All right. Well, we had the opportunity to put in a 42-kilowatt solar array, and we had a cold storage building, and it uses a lot of electricity, and so we were trying to kind of lessen our footprint, and I worked with a guy by the name of Bill Jordan at Jordan Energy, and, you know, we were able to put together a program. This was 5 years ago, and in that five-year period, the cost of installing has gone down by half. We were $8 a kilowatt, and I understand right now it's $4 a kilowatt or less. I'm sorry, not kilowatt, watt. And so that has come down. But, yes, we generate a fair amount of the electricity. In the months of April, May, June, July, we just don't use any electricity. You know, the storage is hardly running that anyway, but have a lot more sunlight. Of course, in the winter, the reverse is true. Particularly this time of year, we're cooling the fruit down, and the sunlight is becoming less and less.
Well, I think that's one of those things that is easy to forget if you're not like up there on the farm, but you are coming to the market regularly and you see apples as kind of one of those like staple winter crops. And a big part of like what the tools that you have to make sure the apples we're getting throughout the season are kind of like crisp and delicious is the storage facility. Can you tell us a little bit about like what it means to store an apple? What are some of the best practices? And what is the kind of life you can get out of an apple in storage?
Well, you know, the technology continually changes and improves. We have two types of storages. We have what we call air storage or 32-degree storage, and that's simply refrigerating down to 32 or 34 degrees, and, you know, it's a normal atmosphere. For longer-term storage, for anything from January on, we have what we call controlled atmosphere storage. And what we do is we reduce the amount of oxygen in the room to around 2.5%. What we do is we increase the amount of nitrogen. Nitrogen already is making up about 78% of the atmosphere anyway. So we increase that up to about 97.5%. And we have the technology now. They actually have a compressor with a filter that segregates nitrogen molecules from oxygen molecules and puts the nitrogen back in the room to bring it down to that level. And then it's a airtight room, so you have to monitor it because the apples, even though they're basically in hibernation, they still respire and they still use oxygen, so you have to constantly monitor on a daily basis to add a little oxygen, but not too much.
So to kind of keep things in. And what about, I know with like some root vegetables, there's like arguments around whether you should wash it before you store it or wash it after you store it. Does that come into play with apples as well?
No, what we do is we keep the humidity in the room relatively high. The refrigeration units will frost up, so they have to be defrosted. And that defrost water, I let it go down on the floor and just keep the moisture up so the apples don't dehydrate. Now, some apples dehydrate much more quickly than others, Golden Delicious being a prime example of one that they'll get wrinkly because they're dehydrated. They're still a decent apple, but they're just not... They don't hold the turgor pressure and the firmness that, you know, you would associate with a great apple. You know, there's other apples that, you know, no matter what you do to them, like, you know, Fuji's really good. You know, Rome's, for all its negativity, is also a great storage apple. So, yeah, there are some differences, but, you know, you can keep those apples pretty easily into April and May. Once they come out, you know, their shelf life is not going to remain high for a super long period of time, but certainly for a month or 5 or 6 weeks.
So if I want to buy, you know, a bushel of apples at their peak and take them home and store them in my fridge, what can I expect as far as, like, prime storage time in my, like, home fridge environment?
Well, I just had a guy, it's interesting you bring that up. I had a customer, and he said, you know, I still have 6 Jonagolds from last year in my refrigerator, and they're still edible.
Wow.
So I thought that was pretty impressive. You know, I would tell you, you know, put them in a – they can't be in a bag that doesn't breathe because apples release ethylene, and they will over-ripen. But, you know, you want them to stay moist. So, you know, you put them in your refrigerator with maybe a wet towel over them or something like that. And I think it's amazing how long some of these varieties do go. You know, the one we always suggest is Ida Red. It seems to last, you know, for a very long period of time and still stay in very good shape. So, if you come to pick your own and you want to keep a lot of apples for a long period of time, that's one of those you should have. And, you know, maybe if you want a selection, some of the other varieties, you eat them up first, and then, you know, just be selective in what you take and how long you store it.
Well, kind of speaking of that, like the pick your own and kind of getting kind of boots on the farm, you know, there's so many great orchards in the Northeast, and I think it's really a fall tradition to go on site and to do picking and to do picking your own. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit, like, what makes this region so great for growing apples?
Well, in Milton and in the Hudson Valley in general, we have a lot of ridges, a lot of rolling hills. And they create a frost-free environment. So when the apples are in bloom in the spring, they are very susceptible to freezing temperatures. And, you know, that's the one thing that, that really we have always have consistent cropping up on these high hills. We have a great market in the New York metro area. And, you know, historically, we're on the Hudson River, and historically we were able to ship fruit overnight once they steamboats, you know, had a system. They would pick the fruit up that was picked in the morning. They would pick it up in the afternoon, deliver it to New York City that night, and would be sold the next day. And, it, you know, it doesn't get any better than that today. And that was, you know, 150 years ago.
Well, I think, yeah, some things change. Things change in all different directions and super fast, it feels like, these days. One of the things that I am focusing on the Farm Report for this fall season is it's really kind of trying to drill into kind of the numbers. How do we kind of quantify and think about what are the critical measurements? And I'm wondering, for you at Prospect Hill Orchards, what are some of those kind of spaces that you look to kind of assess how things are going in a given day or season? What are the ways that you kind of break that down?
Well, you know, it's like this coming weekend, and you know, we're ordering cider. You know, what's the weather going to be, or what is the perception of the weather? We think the weather's going to be pretty decent, except for maybe Saturday morning up until 9 or 10. Then we think after that it's going to be good. But, you know, if you're going to drive for 2 hours and make that kind of commitment, you want to be absolutely sure. So, you know, we're kind of hedging a little bit, thinking that, you know, this weekend may be off a little bit. But when we're measuring it on site, you know, we look at how full is the parking lot. You know, we look at how many of our buckets are out in the orchard and how many are left to go out. And then you can count the number of boxes of bags that, you know, you've gone out. And you get a pretty good idea of what kind of day it's going to be.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like the weather is like such a thing. Yeah, I feel like we get a little skittish at the almost any sign of rain. I'm definitely getting, I keep getting warnings on my phone about Hurricane Joaquin. Is that something that you guys are hearing anything about?
We watch the weather 3 times a day, guaranteed. we do, you know, our opinion is that the Weather Channel, they're making this into a media event. And, you know, they like the viewership, so they hype it probably more than they should. You know, what we're seeing now, the last forecast I saw at lunchtime, it looks to me like it's going to be more of a coastal event. You know, you may see more of it down in the city. We're going to see less of it up here. It looks like morning showers on Tuesday, and that's about it.
So good time to get out of town and head up your way, it sounds like.
Hey, this is good, yeah. Well, there's a lot to do up here. You know, there's pick-your-owns. We have 4 wineries in town. We have the walkway over the Hudson. There's just a lot of neat things to do in the area, and if you want to expand a little bit and go over to the Shawangunk Mountains, you know, there's hiking trails, there's biking trails. The Mid-Hudson area just has a lot to do.
Sold. I am sold. Well, Steve, thank you so much. It's been great chatting with you and get a little insight on what you have going on up at Prospect Hill Orchard.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I hope some of your customers and your listeners will become my customers.
We can do a trade. For folks, if you want to find out more, definitely check out their website, www.prospecthillorchards.com. Also, give a shout out to our sponsor, Escape Maker. They do all the work for you as far as putting together an itinerary. If you're not really sure where to go, but you have a time frame, you have a distance, you have a budget, they can help you pick the right trip for you. And maybe Prospect Hill Orchards will be on that trip. Definitely visit them there, escapemaker.com. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of The Farm Report, a jam-packed show today, as always. Got to give a big shout-out to my engineer, Liz, out there in the booth, making things run smoothly for me. And once again, thanks to Escape Maker for helping us bring radio to you every week. If you have not been to the New Heritage Radio Network website, what is going on? You have a phone in your hand right now. Just check it out. Would love to hear your thoughts. Would love to hear what you think about the features. Definitely check out the topics page. If you're into the Farm Report, I recommend checking out the agriculture tab and the food advocacy tag. Lots of good stuff in there. A chance to explore all of our amazing shows. And if you're out there listening live, hang tight. Eating Matters is coming up next. They got a great episode exploring animal welfare and food labeling. So stay tuned for that. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.